It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Wisconsin is rolling out the production of industrial hemp, a crop which it hasn't produced in about seven decades, but which farmers say may well be a life-saving crop for them. What can hemp do, and what are the issues we have to be aware of in rolling it out? Jennifer Heaton Amrine is the policy analyst at AgChem Management and Plant Industry Bureaus in the Division of Agricultural Resource Management at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Production. She is with us to talk about industrial hemp, what it can do, and what the issues are that surround it. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So briefly, what does the state's pilot program on industrial hemp allow for?
We are licensing growers to try out growing industrial hemp and processors for processing industrial hemp. We give out the licenses and register them, and they're telling us what they're trying to learn this year.
Okay, and what are they trying to learn?
The growers are looking at different seed varieties. They're growing hemp for different purposes, whether it be seed, fiber, grain, CBD production. Processors are looking at different types of things that they can make as well. We're seeing how hemp grows differently in Wisconsin than it does in some of the other pilot states. What does our soil types, how does that make a difference, the climate? So there's a lot of things that after 70 years we really need to think about and learn.
So seed, what can hemp seed do?
You can put hemp seed, you can grow it for other growers to use and grow for things, or there's different hemp seeds that you can press for oil, and some hemp seeds that can go into food. So there's a lot of different varieties of things you can do.
And CBD oil, I've heard it can do a lot of miraculous things. People who believe in CBD oil really believe in CBD oil and CBD pills and what have you. What is it that the industry here is looking at?
They're looking at a variety of different things. You know, our department doesn't take a strong position on it. It's just one of those products that you can press out of the flower as long as the crop is 0.3% THC or below. It's one of the things you can get an extract for, and processors are trying it for different marketing purposes.
So how many growers have applied for this program?
We had 245 grower licenses issued. That was close to the number who applied. There were a few people that didn't finish their application. And then we had 99 processor license issued.
99. So why is it that it has to be a pilot program? Are you worried that people might say, hey, I want to grow hemp, and then grow the full-blown marijuana plant instead?
Well, officially, industrial hemp is still made from the same plant as marijuana. And so the marijuana cannabis is a controlled substance under the federal controlled substance law. So there was a carve-out in the 2014 Farm Bill that allowed states to have industrial hemp pilot programs as long as the THC content was 0.3% and below.
Okay, so now this fascinates me. If it is technically the same plant, how do they take out the THC?
It's just bred differently, and so the only difference and the only way you can tell the difference is through a test. And we are going out to all of our growers, and as they get close to harvest, we take a sample of their plant and we run it in our regulatory lab and see what the THC content is.
And what happens if the THC content is maybe a little higher than you expected?
If it's a little bit higher, and we do expect that to happen, that there will be some that are a little bit higher because, again, this is a pilot program. We're growing in different climates and growing conditions. They have a chance for a retest. If that doesn't work, we do ask for a crop destruction, and we verify that the crop has been destructed if it doesn't meet the standards. There could be a possibility in the future of allowing the parts of the plants that don't have THC to be used for other purposes. So that's called reconditioning, where you would take out the flowers or the buds that might be a little bit over and do something with the stems and stalks.
And do something like create rope and things like that.
Correct.
So where are we in the growing season?
We're getting towards the end of the growing season. We've just started to get requests for us to come out and do that regulatory sample that takes place anytime 30 days prior to harvest. So what we saw in the planting reports that all of our growers filed was that mid-September is about when people are expecting to harvest. But it could be any time from the beginning of September until probably about the end of September, early October, that the harvest will be taking place.
And you're growing hemp all over the state, so do you expect the harvest to be different in the southern part of the state than, say, in the middle or northern part of the state?
It could be. We had growers plant at quite variable times this year due partially on when they could get seed and partially on the weather. We had a real rainy May in parts of Wisconsin. So it depends partially on that. We also have people that are experimenting as part of their research plan of how late can you plant and still get a crop? Can you get two crops? So it could be that harvest goes a lot longer or shorter depending on when they plant and kind of what their research project is.
So
but
for this,
most people, it looks like, are going to harvest in September.
So for this pilot program, there's only a few farms that are involved. What are you looking for in the future beyond this program?
We're really looking for hemp to be a popular crop in Wisconsin that can be used as part of a farm's regular rotation. I mean, we know it grows here. We were one of the top states in the United States 70 years ago, and that's why there's been so much excitement about Wisconsin starting the industrial hemp pilot program, is people know that we have good conditions for it. But seeds have changed, and, you know, the people who grew it back then aren't around now, so we've still got a lot to learn in terms of planting and harvesting.
Interesting.
And markets.
Do you know a little bit about the history of why it was stopped 70 years ago?
Well, it was very popular for World War II, and then when the Controlled Substances Act came in to be, that was really the push that made it illegal.
So Wisconsin's pilot program is not the only one in the country. How many other states are doing this, and how do we compare?
About 30 to 35 other states now have industrial hemp pilot program laws on the books. Not all of those have active programs. But one of the biggest differences between Wisconsin's program and other states is that we really are open to anybody. A lot of states are limiting the number of growers, limiting the number of processors, picking and choosing. And we've our authorizing legislation said, you know, if you apply and meet the requirements, you can grow industrial hemp in Wisconsin. And that has really allowed a wide variety of research projects to be out there, a wide variety of types of people to be involved. Again, we have it all over the state. So I think the way that the legislature wrote the law really allowed for our program to develop in a different way than maybe some other states that were more restrictive.
So talk to me about the research projects. You're looking at things to do with hemp that we don't already know how to do.
Yep, we will be. Right now, a lot of the research, and again, it's applied research because these growers aren't, you know, affiliated with the university necessarily.
Right.
So the growers are really looking at it from an applied research perspective of how do we plant this, what kind of harvest techniques, how can we use our current equipment to grow hemp, does no-till work, what time of year should we plant? So we're looking at those very basic research questions. How much water does it take? What kind of soil, you know, what kind of fertilizer, how much do we need? There are no commercial pesticides allowed on industrial hemp. So how does weed pressure affect it? And how can we control weeds without pesticides? How about insects? So those are the kind of the basic questions that people are asking right now.
Jennifer Heaton Amrine is a policy advisor for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Her primary concentration for the last 20 years has been agro-environmental issues. Thanks for joining us, Jennifer.
Thank you.
It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. The National Park Service is facing a conundrum. There are so many visitors. Many popular parks need urgent maintenance, but the funding isn't there. So the NPS has turned to outside vendors to license clothing and outdoor equipment and sometimes even give tours at parks. How much does the National Park Service get from this? Not enough, according to our next guest. Did you visit a national park this summer? Was it busier than usual? Have you bought branded Park Service clothing? Are you surprised to learn that the Park Service doesn't get all the revenue? Give us a call this morning, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we love Twitter, WPR Mornings. Jen A. Miller is a freelance writer. She wrote a piece for The Outline called Clothing Companies Are Funding Our National Parks Because the Government Won't. Jen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So your article focuses on outdoor clothing companies that have partnered with the National Park Service, basically to help fund the agency. How long has this partnership been in place?
Well, actually, the first partnership was with a nonprofit back in 1923,
wow.
7 years after the National Park Service was founded. So there are 70 of those nonprofit partnerships, and they do things like they do now, like run tours and educational stuff like that. The private partnerships are not that old. Things like we're going to talk about
the corporate,
in this interview.
The corporate partnerships,
right, the corporate
yes.
ones are not new. But they really started ramping up 2 years ago around the centennial celebration of the national parks. And a lot of them have stuck on and are continuing to do this, what seems like a very nice thing, even though it's not going to meet the budget gap.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. So let me distinguish, though, between the not-for-profits who've been around, who are friends of the parks, and everything that they get, it goes to park services, right?
Right. Or they set up actually on the national parks. The first one was in Yosemite, and the Yosemite Conservancy is still there.
Okay.
This is different. These are outside companies that you can buy their stuff essentially anywhere because of the internet.
How many companies are we talking about?
I couldn't get an exact number just because the partnerships change or they become bigger, they become smaller, but they're fairly well-known companies that we can talk about, like
mm-hmm.
REI,
mm-hmm.
Land's End just announced one, Pendleton, and Hanes just announced one after this story ran.
Hanes, the underwear
it's
company.
Not National Park underwear. But it's T-shirts and things like that.
Okay, fine. So L.L. Bean is an interesting one to me. That they recently made this huge donation to NPS. Tell us more about this.
Well, that's pretty typical as to how these things start. They make a big donation, and then they say, we're going to create these items that a portion of the sales will go to the National Park Foundation, which is the nonprofit for the National Park Service that was set up by an act of Congress. So I know more about REI because they're in the story that I wrote, and they give 5% of their National Park branded gear to the National Park Foundation. The L.L. Bean one was announced the day before the story read.
I see. But here's the thing, that if I buy a T-shirt and it's got the National Park Service logo, I'm expecting that this is going to go to the National Park Service, and you're telling me only 5% of that $25 that I've spent is going to the NPS.
Well, it's actually going to the NPF, which is the foundation.
Okay.
Just the technical thing that I had to make clear in the story. All of the people I talked to for this story make it very, very clear that it's only a portion that goes to the National Park Foundation. And even a lot of stuff you will purchase in a national park, if you went to the visitor center, it's the same way. Unless it has the National Park Foundation logo on it, there is the main logo that's been around for 100 years that they don't let anybody else use, and there's a different logo that they let everybody else use. So even if you go, like I went to Yellowstone last year and I bought a sweatshirt that was made by a vendor, and a portion of that went to the National Park Foundation. So it's kind of the same, but if you go buy the Brooks Yosemite running shoes, all that money is not going to the National Park Foundation.
We're talking with Jen A. Miller about the funding circumstances of America's national parks. Do you think national parks should be government funded? Do you worry your favorite landmarks could suffer if the funding gap persists? What impression did a national park leave in your memory? We've got a line for you right now, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org and tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Jen, the parks project is the funding arm of the National Park Service. The National Park Service is a government organization. Why does it have to have a different funding arm?
It has to do with the way that the National Park Foundation was set up through an act of Congress. Was they wanted a dedicated organization to be able, because there's, if you want to give to a government agency or like, you can't donate money to the Department of Defense. So it's a way for people to donate money to a different organization that then helps with the National Park Service. It has to do with the way that people can donate money to the government.
Okay, so what does the funding arm do? What does the National Parks Foundation do?
So they do a lot of things. The National Park Service has a budget. There's a $12 billion gap. The National Park Foundation can go out and fundraise for specific projects. They can start volunteer programs. They can bring kids into national parks to sort of get them interested in the national parks and sort of fund like their lunches and stuff like that. So they can try to meet the gap that in the budget of the National Park Service by doing specific projects. And the money that is donated from these companies that are selling these products to support the national parks, all that money gets dumped to the National Park Foundation. And then they can funnel the money as to where they see fit.
I should note that our producer looked Haynes up, because we were talking about underwear, and she said it has 23 different T-shirts and national park logos listed on their website, from generic Campic ones or the Rockies or the Grand Canyon to the Golden Gate and Sequoia National Parks. Very interesting. I want to talk about the park project. Is this different? This is about maintaining parks, right?
So the Parks Project is actually another for-profit company. They were founded by a bunch of people who worked at Tom's, the shoe company that you buy a pair of shoes, they give a pair of shoes.
Right.
And even though they are not a nonprofit, they were set up specifically to sell well-designed national park merchandise. There's a very much of a vintage hipster vibe to their stuff. But they also have helped with branding of the national park, so that their hashtag, the national park hashtag, is Find Your Park. And they have worked on that for them. They have done sort of made their online merchandise, the National Park Service merchandising online, better for them. But they also make their own gear and donate a portion of the sales to the National Park Foundation. They would not tell me how much that is, even though in the National Park Service annual report, it was somewhere between $25,000 and $999,000. I mean, it's a big gap.
That's a
there,
huge gap.
That's all
yeah.
I can get for this story.
Okay, so what's interesting, so this is the hashtag Find Your Park, is that it?
Yes.
So you started your story with going to that hashtag Find Your Park.
So
tell me about that, yeah.
So last summer, I took a four-month road trip to see the 18 states I hadn't been to yet, and I decided to see, I want to see all 417 sites that are run by the National Park Service. So, you know, I would take pictures along the way, also to tell my parents where I was, and I would post them on Instagram with the hashtag Find Your Park. And that is when I started seeing ads for Parks Project, because that's, you know, the way the Instagram algorithms work.
Mm-hmm.
And this year I went to three more sites when I was on a road trip up to Woodstock, and I did it again and the ads popped up again. And I was like, well, what is this? I want to better understand how this whole thing works.
So if you just are on Twitter and you think you're supporting your national parks, what you're doing is giving information to advertisers who have licensed national parks logos.
Or anybody who wants to know people who are outdoorsy. I mean, that's the way the internet works. Like when my dog passed away last year and I posted that she died, I started getting ads for cremation services. So, you know, that's just the way the internet works.
You know, it was really creepy. We did a Harley Davidson show on Friday. I did not use my phone to look up any Harley Davidson things. And all of a sudden, I'm starting to get ads for Harley Davidson just from talking about it on the air. So I'm a little creeped out about that, too.
Yeah.
I want to know about these the reason these companies do this, they make a lot of money off this, don't they?
They probably do. It's one of those things, again, where they didn't want to tell me. But, I mean, I've written about REI before. I've spoken at length to Parks Project. It seems like they are really invested in doing something. REI has days where their employees can go out and volunteer at national parks. It seems like there is more. It's not just them saying, well, let's do this to make money. And part of it is these partnerships. Parks Project is in their third year. I believe REI is at least 3 years. They've stuck with it. They didn't just do it for the centennial and then say, okay, we did it. That's enough. L.L. Bean doing it is a big deal because it is such a big, long-running company. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they make money, but I don't think it's why they do this, if that makes sense.
Is it helping them brand?
Of course it is. I mean, you know, I didn't know what Parks Project was until I saw their national park shirts. And REI, you know, they made trail running shoes with Brooks, the shoe company. So, of course it does it. I mean, it makes me feel better about being an REI co-op member. But, you know, I mean, they're giving money to the National Park Foundation, so I don't feel like it's smarmy or anything like that, if that makes sense.
Yes, we are talking to freelance writer Jen Miller. She writes about the outdoors, and she wrote specifically about national parks with a piece called Clothing Companies Are Funding Our National Parks Because the Government Won't. We're going to be back with more from Jen in a moment. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. There is a nearly $12 billion backlog in repair funding for the National Park Service, but the budget for the NPS is only $3.4 billion, and that, according to today's guest, isn't even keeping up with inflation. Do you think national parks should be publicly funded? How about state parks? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or go on the Twitter and type WPR Mornings. Jen Miller writes about the outdoors, and she wrote a piece recently called Clothing Companies Are Funding Our National Parks Because the Government Won't. So, Jen, let's talk about this funding gap, this $12 billion in repairs. And you go to a national park that is really crowded, like Zion, which is near where I used to live. And yeah, it's like you're marching up the trail with lots of people. You can't go faster. You can't slow down. And there is lots of, I would think, damage being done just in terms of the traffic. So lots of people are coming to see parks, and that means that they need more maintenance. And then there's this eight plus billion dollar gap in what is funded and what they need to do to maintain the parks.
Well, and the problem is, I mean, it's the national parks are so successful that they're that it's hurting themselves. For the last 5 years, visiting to the national parks has been up, and not just the number of visits, which if you look at the numbers from 2016 to 2017, it looks like they're getting the same number of visits. However, people are staying and staying longer. So in 2016, they had 19 million recreational hours by visitors. In 2017, it jumped to 1.44 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, so like sometimes the national park I go to the most is a Valley Forge Historic National Park in Pennsylvania. So sometimes I can take my dog for an hour. Sometimes I can run there for 3 hours. So people are staying, and they're staying longer, and they're doing more things. So there's been wear and tear on the national parks, mm-hmm. and these things need to get fixed. And if they don't get fixed, they get worse. If they don't get fixed, they get worse. So it's that sort of loop that's spinning down and down and down, and these things should be taken care of, and they're not.
Okay, so let's talk about why this gap exists. You would think that the federal government would look and say, "Whoa, we've got lots of customers. We should service our customers so that they have a good experience and they and more people might come." Why don't they do that?
I wish I could tell you. So this budget gap has existed since 2010, and it sort of stayed at the same level. And it looks like on paper that the budget has gone up. However, when you adjust it for inflation, the budget has actually gone down 8%. So with the current administration, they are saying, well, we want to fix this, and we can fix this if you allow energy development in the national parks, things like opening. Yeah, and that sort of gets...
And this is the Rob Portman bill, right? Senator Portman has put forward a bill, yes.
And that's called the Restore Our National Parks Act, which sounds wonderful. It was introduced by Senator Rob Portman, a Republican from Ohio. But what it does is allows energy development on federal lands. And that is something that a lot of people don't want because you don't want drilling in our national parks.
Right.
I don't know your personal beliefs, but I don't want drilling in our national parks.
Well, it seems to me it would limit the customer experience.
Oh, of course. And, you know, even shaving down national parks or making them smaller to allow drilling. It's a very controversial thing, and it's being presented by the administration as the only way to fix this, and that seems there has to be more than that.
it's a question between capitalism and democracy and how that sort of works together or not. But my question here is that you said 2010. Were the National Park Services totally funded before 2010?
Probably not. There's probably always been more that the national parks wanted to do, but it's just that was when the visitorship started really exploding and the wear and tear got worse and worse and worse.
We are taking your calls today about national parks. Do you visit national parks? Do you have a favorite? Have you noticed that it's starting to get a little crowded? Would you mind if the federal government licensed out drilling on national parks properties? How would that affect your visit? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Jen Miller, the changes to the national park budget under when were they? Did you do any research on like when they were highest?
They've pretty much been. It seems like it's been the same for the last since 2010. But again, it's that explosion of visitorship that happened around the same time.
And why? Why 2010? Why did we all start going to national parks then?
Because that's the numbers that were available.
it's just really fascinating to me. I grew up in Las Vegas, going to the national parks around Utah, and there weren't any in Nevada at the time. They would be really nice and pleasant. And then I moved back there and took my kids to Zion and was like, whoa, where did all these people come from? And
well, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Well, I mean, I grew up in the Philadelphia area, and I can tell you I've been to the Liberty Bell exactly once because it might not seem like something like Liberty Bell is a national quote-unquote park, but it is a national park site.
Right.
So the Hoover Dam, being from Las Vegas, is a national park site.
Indeed.
It might just be that, you know, I know personally as I knew more at the Centennial 2 years ago, and then following the changes with climate change, part of me wants to see things before things change, I guess. And I know I'm not the only person who feels that way, but there's definitely more awareness of the national park since the Centennial 2 years ago. And I think it's only going to increase from then.
So there are more customers. Do you see this translating into political action? Are more customers who are going to national parks also calling their congressmen and telling them to fund it?
Well, I was in Zion last year before the 4th of July, which was a very, very busy time. And I saw a lot of people in Make America Great hats, which seemed like this administration doesn't want big government. They want private, you know, they don't want to take care of these public lands. So it seems because they feel like they want small government. So I know that a lot of my outdoors friends are calling and lobbying. And last year, the Interior's Department announced that they were going to shave down some national parks like Bears Ears and Escalante. Mm-hmm. But since then, it hasn't really been in the news so much.
To be fair, Bears Ears and Escalante, at least Bears Ears, was designated just a few years before by the Obama administration, right?
Right, correct.
What did, in terms of the money that is generated from REI and L.L. Bean and all those places, how much does the National Park Services get from that? And does it come close to making up for this gap?
Well, all of it goes to the National Park Foundation, who then funnels it to what they do. I mean, I think I described it in the story as it's like dropping a rock in the Grand Canyon. It just, we can't buy enough sweatshirts. We can't buy enough running shoes. We can't buy enough national park blankets to meet this $12 billion gap. It's nice that it exists and these companies are doing this, and they are doing very important projects, especially in the busiest national parks. 42 national park sites last year broke visitorship records that they set in 2016.
Wow.
So yeah, it's not just that it's not that a couple more people are visiting. It's just exploded, especially in these very busy parks like Zion, like Rocky Mountain, like Great Smoky. And they're trying to, they want people to visit these parks and have a good experience too. So if, like when I went to Zion and I was waiting for the shuttle bus and I'm trying to hike in the Narrows with about 12 billion other people.
Yes.
They want people to go and have a good experience so that they come back.
National Park Services has been talking about actually pulling back on the number of people they will let in at a daily rate in the parks. Do you think that's a good solution?
I don't think that's gaining a lot of traction. And it's the same thing with there were proposals to for the most popular national parks to make the fee to get in a lot higher.
Right.
And there was big pushback about that. I think Grand Canyon went up $5 instead of like $30 sort of thing. Senior passes went from $10 to $80, and that's pretty much the biggest jump that we've seen. And those are lifetime passes. My mom actually made sure to go out and get hers before the price jumped so she could come with me to the national parks.
There were a lot of people doing that. There was like a rush on people
did.
Getting, yes.
She rushed down to one in southern New Jersey by the beach and made sure to get her pass so that she can go see these things, and she's used it quite a bit since then.
And go ahead.
Go ahead, sorry.
I assume that clothing companies are making a pretty penny off of this, though.
I mean, it's good PR. I mean, it does make me feel good. I did get a Parks Project sweatshirt for the conservation. I'm going to mess this name up. It was the original group that formed to sort of do the national parks during the Depression. It's on the tip of my tongue. Conservation Corp, where it sent young men out to gave them jobs.
Yes, yes. Like Conservation Corps. CCC.
Yes. Yes.
Civilian CCC. Conservation Corps. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. It's early in New Jersey, too. And it's a neat sweatshirt. And I didn't buy it. My dad bought it for me for Christmas. I asked him to. And I, you know, people ask me about what the heck is that? And I know what it is. And obviously Parks Project knows what it is. But they said that their goal, and they are making money off this, just like Tom's makes money off their shoes, is to inspire these conversations too. Because the more that I got into national parks and posted pictures of national parks and wore my sweatshirt for national parks, the more that people asked and were interested in going to these places. And I think it's also important to note that the National Park Service oversees 416 sites, I believe that's the number. 60 national parks, but 416 national park sites.
Like the Liberty Bell and those kinds of things.
Liberty Bell, battlefields, military parks, national seashores, all sorts of things when you really drill down into the list. A lot of those places are free. And sometimes I went to one in Ohio where I was the only person there. So funding also keeps these things open. They're important parts of our national story that don't get as much attention, but still are very important, I think, at least. I'm going to Acadia National Park next week in Maine, but I'm also going to St. Croix, which is on the border of Maine and Canada and has an important part in the history of how the border of Maine and the United States and Canada formed.
We are talking to outdoor writer Jen Miller. She has written about national parks and about how clothing companies are funding our national parks, but she says it's just a drop in the bucket. We're going to be coming back with your phone calls about your national park experiences in a moment. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Our National Park Service is in a crisis, according to the New York Times. Government funding can't keep up with maintenance, and yet park attendance is up so much, even more maintenance is needed. For many years, the NPS has been pairing with private companies to brand the NPS logo in exchange for part of the sales revenue. But these public-private partnerships do not generate enough revenue, says our guest, outdoors writer Jen Miller. Do you worry that national parks could suffer if the funding gap persists? Do you think corporations supporting the national parks are just doing it for the PR, or are they really trying to help? 1-800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. That's our email, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jen, we've got a couple of phone calls coming in. Paul from Washington County, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. I attended the Grand Canyon facility, and I found it was at a stockyard. Debris all over the place. Some of these people don't do any preparatory study of the facility they're going to for the park, they, you know, such as studying its geology or its geography. I think they have to jack the fees, and they're going to have to control the amount of people that enter that park on a daily basis.
So,
I think if the government doesn't do this, you're going to continue to deteriorate.
So you what you didn't like about the Grand Canyon, your experience was sullied by the fact that your fellow Grand Canyon visitors didn't seem to know or care or have enough reverence for the place.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Paul. We are talking about national parks, and we are taking your calls. Jen, what do you think of that? There are so many people. There's so much trash. National parks do a pretty good job of saying, these are the geological formations that you are seeing here. But people aren't always interested in that. And they don't always have the money to hire the teachers to teach that stuff or to pick up the trash.
Well, I want to address the idea of jacking up the fees. Part of the issue with that is that the purpose of the national park system is that they are public lands. The goal is that they should be affordable to everyone. And that was where the big pushback on raising the fees for the most popular national parks like Grand Canyon, like Zion came from, is that if the fees are too high, it's going to be unaffordable for people. So that's the argument against, I understand the idea of raising the fees to generate revenue. But again, if the parks are underfunded, you know, even raising the fees is not going to meet that gap. A lot of the people who give tours in the national parks are volunteers. So is there more need for volunteer education? Possibly. But again, if you pay people to give the tours, they might be more educated as to what to say, I guess, is the best way to do it. There was a story a while ago that somebody went on one of the tours of the Liberty Bell, and the things that the people were saying, the guides, were very incorrect. I hate to laugh about it, but it was really funny. But that media exposure of what they were saying led to better education of the tour guides. So,
interesting. We are taking your calls here about national parks, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So we talked a few minutes ago about Senator Rob Portman's bill that would fund national parks. Would they fund them to the $12 million maintenance backlog that they have?
From what I read, its goal would be to do that.
Okay.
But also the way that they would do that is to allow energy development on federal land. So I don't know how far that's actually going to get. Obviously,
right.
Nothing's happening right now. But there will be there has been some pushback already, and I imagine there will be more if this actually progresses through.
So if this gets through, like one of the things that we're talking about are these environmental concerns. But other people have said that just having so many people tramp through these parks pose environmental concerns. Our caller just said there's a lot of trash in these parks. That poses environmental concerns. Are you worried about the influx, the overflow of people and what they're doing to the land?
Of course. And actually, a lot of these national parks don't allow you to hike with your dogs for the same reason.
Mm.
I don't know what the best way to meter these crowds are. And also, it's a pretty recent resurgence, so there hasn't been a lot of time to sort of adjust to this. We talked about Zion. When I went out to the Narrows, there's a bus shuttle through Zion, but there's only one road out and one road in.
Yes.
How much can you actually do other than add more shuttle buses? And then there was an issue when I was there. It was a private vehicle actually went off the road and partly into the water.
Oh, great.
Yeah. But the parks do limit, they have been limiting the number of cars that can go in. And when the parking lots are full, you have to wait. So that's sort of a way that it self-regulates. But it would be helpful if there were more feasibility studies. I mean, you think about, you go to Disney World and how many people they put through Disney World. Although they do eventually shut Disney World down. And there are some places like Sandy Hook in New Jersey, where if the parking lots are full, that's it. You're done. You don't let anybody else in. Is that fair? I don't know. I mean, you get there early, right?
Right.
So there are steps that can be taken. One thing that was proposed was you have to reserve a time to go. And there are some places in the national park.
Yes, there are.
Where you have to reserve, like I've taken tours of Mammoth Cave, you actually have to reserve a spot to get into some of those caves. So that could be expanded. But right now it's sort of in a holding pattern.
I'm going to stick with Zion because it is the one that I know most. But the last time I went, I was shopping around in that little town there and talking to shopkeepers, and we were talking about this very thing. And I was like, but you don't want to restrict visitors because you would get less money. And they were like, they never come in. They just drive by. They just take the bus. So maybe restricting visitors or having reservations, people will then spend time in the towns that are near these national parks.
Right. And a lot of those towns, I mean, that's pretty much it all around. I actually parked when I went to Zion, I went in to buy a pair of Chacos. I didn't have them. And the woman said, oh, just park behind the store. And I said, are you sure? And she's like, yeah, nobody's going to come in and park here, which surprised me. But I got on the shuttle bus around 1 o'clock. Everybody who wanted to hike was already in. So it was a little less crowded. And actually, the national parks do promote don't come at peak times or enter the park at different times because of that problem. So me going in at 1 o'clock meant I wasn't trying to get in as soon as the shuttle buses started running.
Right. So what is your advice if people are heading out and they've never really had a national park experience before, but they're going on a road trip somewhere in the national park system? What's your advice for how they should plan?
So what I would recommend is there's this thing called the Passport to Your National Parks. It's a little blue book that lists every single national park site in the country. And every time you go to one, you get a stamp, like a passport. And what I found that when I had that book was when I went to places that are not sort of the name brand national parks. Like, of course, on my trip, I went to Zion. I went to Yellowstone. I went to Grand Teton. But I also went to Bandolier National Monument in New Mexico. I also went to the White Sands National Monument in New Mexico, where there weren't as many people, but also were stunning and beautiful and different. So I recommend picking that up and looking at sites that maybe you haven't heard of before, like the Cayuga Valley National Park in Ohio was stunning, but it wasn't. It's a national park, but it's not Yosemite.
Right.
So you can go to places that aren't going to be as crowded. Anywhere you want to go, I highly recommend looking up, this sounds basic, but their website. Go to basic information. It will have listings as to where the visitor centers are, where their peak times are, if there are any road closures, any warnings. So when I went to White Sands in southern New Mexico, it was really hot, surprising enough. But they said, if you want to hike, here's everything you need to do and know. Because unfortunately, recently, three French tourists went out into the White Sands with one bottle of water between three of them and got lost, and two of them died. So you definitely don't want that, but you want to know every single warning that they're going to give you, or like where are bears, where can you take your dog, where can you not take your dog. So doing that research first can introduce you to places you didn't know about, and also make your experience much better.
I should also note that there's something called the National Parks Podcast, which is worth listening to, and it actually teaches you things about the parks, geological formations, and those kinds of things. Jen A. Miller writes about running and the outdoors. She wrote a piece for The Outline entitled, Clothing Companies Are Funding Our National Parks Because the Government Won't. Jen, well, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Next, we're going to talk about the state of organized labor on the Ideas Network. And tomorrow, we're looking at education issues. In advance of the show, we want to know your experience in school. What was your favorite memory of your first day? Call 833-424-3327. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network.